Hey, what's up? I'm Vanessa.
I'm Mary.
I'm Gillian.
I'm Rivka, and this is the very latest episode of the Fufu and Tips podcast.
Your go-to place for relatable content for the African diaspora down under.
The blacker the podcast, the sweeter the bands.
Welcome back to another episode. Today we have a very special edition of Straight From The Pot. I will be speaking to a very dear friend. She's a social worker, a lover of fashion, a gym junkie, and honestly, one of the most inspiring people I know. Today we have Fatu Silla.
Hello.
Hi, how are ya?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm exhausted, but I'm good.
I feel like exhausted is everyone's response in this day and age, but thank you for making the time to speak about your story, which I feel like is, I know bits and pieces of it, and it's a very layered story, but I feel like it's very, very inspiring and empowering, to say the least. But let's start with, like, where are you from? What's your background? Because even that is confusing.
I don't think my background is confusing, but to be clear, so my mother is from Senegal and my dad is from Mali, so I'm kind of mixed both. And obviously my grandfather from my mom's side, they moved to Sierra Leone, and that's where the Sierra Leone comes in.
Makes sense. So you're, what, which one do you claim mostly?
I claim mostly Senegalese, because that's pretty much where we're from. And I take great pride in that.
And where were you born?
I was actually born in Liberia during the Civil War.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was actually born during Civil War, like middle of Civil War, where my mama actually had to get out during the night to go back to Sierra Leone, Freetown.
Yeah. Wow, I had no idea. Can you just start, let's start from the beginning. Can you paint a picture of your life back home? Pick whichever country makes the most sense, and just give a little glimpse of like what was life like from what you can remember.
Oh my God, this is PTSD, but let's reverse it back. So growing up, if what I can remember, my childhood pretty much started with my mum and my mum's side of the family. My dad was involved, but my dad used to be a miner, so he used to travel a lot, and he also had a first wife, so my mum is second wife. So I had stepsisters and stepbrothers. So my stepmom used to live in the village and my mum used to live in Guinea. So my dad used to travel between the two places and my mum used to obviously travel with my dad during the mining days. And so that mean I would be left at home by myself. And so I learned to build quickly relationship around who were around me at the time, like friends and community. And during school holidays, we used to visit my grandfather and my uncles in Sierra Leone, Freetown. I believe it was Bowtown. So I remember that compound. It was the best, kind of like a holiday town, because I really used to love my uncles and my aunties in Freetown. They were really nice. And the compound used to be really big as well. So I used to travel between Guinea and there. I think I was about 5 years old when, like, obviously this comes in a little bit with FGM come through. Then I had FGM done to me. Then I moved to Cote d'Ivoire with my stepsister from my mom, my dad's first marriage.
Whoa. You just dropped a lot of information in that short couple of minutes and I did not know any of that. Okay, so you grew up in obviously a practicing Muslim family?
Correct.
Yeah. And you knew your stepmother well?
Yeah, I knew my stepmother well. She was really lovely. I don't have any negative memory of her, to be honest. She was really nice to me.
And you said you, so FGM, you had female genital mutilation at the age of
six.
And then you said you moved after that. Was there any relation to the FGM, or you guys just moved around?
So moving around was after my stepsister got married from my mom's, my dad's first wife. She got married and she was traveling with her husband to Cote d'Ivoire. So it's like once you get married, you move to different state. So when she got married, I was the younger one at the time. So I don't know who thought it was a good idea to just send me with her. It's kind of like a child raising a child, because she was lost as well herself, and then she was young when she got married.
And this was your stepsister.
Correct.
So your stepsister was meant to help raise you.
Correct. Yeah. So she took me to Cote d'Ivoire to live with her there, with her husband. That was very toxic, pretty much. It was unpleasant. It was not a livable situation, because I was young. And I just feel like she didn't know who she was. And she was a child herself. So she was not able to give me the attention that I needed or the love that I needed.
What's the age gap?
I got mutilated when I was six. So I said that I moved with her when I was around eight for at least a year. And then she was 20 years old at the time. Her husband at the time as well was 20 years old as well. So there was not much age gap, but she was just not...
she wasn't equipped to be a mother.
Correct. She was not knowledgeable of anything, to be honest. And she was not... she didn't have education. So that was a massive part of it as well.
After you were in Cote d'Ivoire with your stepsister... was it a couple of years or months?
No, it was a couple of years. Living with her in Cote d'Ivoire was about, I think it was 3 years I was living with her. It was not the best. So there's that living situation has no happy ending, because it was just full of abuse and neglect. I don't have any good story for her, to be honest. Again, I don't blame her, because I just feel like she just didn't know what life was or who she was as well. But I'm not disregarding the fact that she neglected me and she abused me physically, mentally. But I just don't think that she had the resources to give to me or help me grow, because she was not provided the same resource.
And then when were you reconnected to your parents?
I moved back to Guinea with my parents after living in Cote d'Ivoire for 3 years. In 2000, that's when I came back to live with my mom. That was in Guinea. So when I came back to live with my mom, I think because of the distance, and then because of there's no connection and the long period of time not seeing my mom, I think there was no relationship there. I just felt like I was just an outsider person. Even though I was craving for my mom's attention or love while I was with my stepsister, and wanting to come back because I was neglected there and abused. And I felt like if I come back to my mom, I'll feel love and then have more attention. But it was the opposite. It felt like I was living still with my stepsister, where the abuse still continued and the distance from my family still continued. And I was very lost.
So that's like what, in just your short 8-9 years of life, you'd already been through so much, which I know is a testament to your life at the moment. And we'll get to that in a little bit, but you're very, very strong. And I think your independence is obviously rooted from a lot of the things that you went through when you were younger. But just to make it a little bit more lighthearted, because obviously I know this is probably heavy.
Yeah.
We're recording this late at night. I'm not trying to make you relive any of the bad moments, but what are some of the good moments that you can recall from? Well, firstly, where is home? Like, I didn't know about Côte d'Ivoire. I knew about Senegal. I knew about Guinea.
Mm.
I knew about Mali. What do you call home when people ask where you're from? Where's the motherland for you? Like, which part of the continent is home? Where do you have the best memories?
I think I had a best memory in Guinea. I'm not going to lie. I think that's because I created a space and I created a little community for myself, because my family was in that community. My family was in that supportive of me. So my best memories, like coming home, getting dressed, and my best friend name used to be Makeli. So she used to live across this street from us. So I think the best memories were pretty much living at their place, where we used to, Sundays, we just all used to sit outside, learn how to braid, play soccer, you know, do each other's hair. Like, they had a shop and I used to be at the shop selling things. You know, it was just really nice because I saw how much her mom and dad loved her, and that love was so intense. So I gravitated toward that a lot more. So I was not at home when I'm home. I was more home when I was with her. So she helped me grow. And then she, even though I didn't know what love was, but I felt it when I'm around her. So that part of Guinea was home for me. But when it comes to family wise, there's not sense of love or sense of belonging to my family. So asking this question, I'm just like, actually I lied. Like, there was time that where I was really connected to my uncles because I saw them as role models, and because of the way my mom used to treat them. Like, they used to come from different suburbs in Guinea and come to my mom's house, and my mom used to cook for them. And I used to really think that they were cool, the way they used to dress, the way they used to carry themselves, all that. But obviously, the more I get to know them and live with one of them, I'm like, you're not all that. Like, I looked up to you, but you're really not a good person. And that was disappointing. Yeah.
So your best memories were in Guinea, just being a child, just getting to play outside, play with the other kids, just be free in your childlike nature. What about, so by this time that you're back in Guinea, you're about how old?
About 12.
12. And then what was the initial starting point for Australia to even be on your mind, or even be an option to move to? How did that all come about?
Australia wasn't an option. I didn't know Australia even existed. It's funny story how I got to Australia. I swear to God, I used to say, I tell people I'm a middle child. I have a middle child syndrome. You're stuck in the middle. Like, you're not loved, but no one hate you either. So you're just there, but people forget about you half the time. So my mom used to travel a lot with my sister and my brother. So I will always remain back home, like in the house that we used to live at. So let's say one day, it turned out my mom was home. This guy from nowhere, literally, I can actually see him walking into the compound and then walking straight to my mom, and then being given to my mom my paperwork and be like, hey, I have this paperwork. It can get people to Australia. It turned out to be refugee status, you know, paperwork. It was like, just give me $50. That was
equivalent. $50?
$50, literally 50 bucks. I'm not even, because that was the money back then. This was like 2004.
And you were how old then?
I think I was 12. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I was 12. Because I came to Australia when I was 13. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was like, I can put your name on this one. You guys, like, all you have to do is give me money. The refugee camp, they do interviews. All I have to do is lodge your application in, then they'll call you for interview and I'll introduce you to someone else. And literally that's how it worked. So my mom put my name down and my uncle's name down and my brother's name down. and they send it off. And then I think it was 2 weeks later, they literally call us for interview. It turned out again, because I'm always left behind. My brother was in, end up leaving to go to Sierra Leone, and my mom as well. So he couldn't make it for the interview. So it was left me and my uncle, Nuru, and then we end up going for the interview.
Wow. And so what was in it for that guy? Like, that was his little side hustle, getting $50.
Yeah, that was literally his side hustle. And he just gave to us. And then, obviously, again, it was a lot of money in African, you know, franc Guinea. But that was all he needed. And yeah, 2 weeks later, I went for the interview. I remember going to the interview. I was so nervous. I was so lost as well, because I'm like, what the hell is going on? So, yeah. And
did you look up Australia at that time?
No, I didn't look up Australia at that time. I looked up Australia. Actually, I didn't look up Australia. So after the interview was successful, they gave us funding for 2 weeks. I think it was 2 weeks. You have to go to this class where they will teach you about Australia. I think that's how I actually even learned about Australia. And then they will tell you about that whole class, the 2 weeks, is all about Australian life, what's happening there, the currency they use, the lifestyle, the support you will receive when you come here as a refugee, who you'll be with, like these resources that are available to you as a refugee. That's literally what they teach you. And then they will give you like $400, and then that's it.
Wow. So what was the interview like? What type of questions did they ask you? Because at this point, you know English, right?
I know no English. So they had a translator that would speak French. So the interview question was, so the application, you have to write a story about why you are a refugee. So that story has to match your interview answers, because they'll go back to that and then see the review and see if the answers match. And then I had to do revision over and over again. And being a kid at the time, I didn't have to do a lot of speaking. There was my uncle that did most of the talking for us. So that's, yeah.
And your uncle was also successful?
Yeah, my uncle, because it was meant to be five of us on the application, but only me and my uncle made it, because the interview was so fast that my brother couldn't travel from Sierra Leone to Guinea, even though it's a 6-hour drive. But it was just that quick that he couldn't make it.
Wow, I've never actually heard of a story of what the process is for like a refugee status.
Yeah.
So it's not that you were in any sort of danger or any sort of harm or any sort of civil war. It just literally, someone just came to your house and handed you the opportunity, literally.
Correct. That was exactly what it was. And that was just before the civil war was just about to finish as well. Yeah.
And you said they handed you $400, and that's $400 to like support your migration?
Yes, correct. I think that's also to use in Africa to buy things that you need to buy for when you come to Australia.
So after they handed you that money, what was the next process? Did you have to travel somewhere?
No, you didn't have to travel anywhere. Or they give you a date of when you come into Australia. You start packing your bag, and then they will give you time where to meet up at the airport. And then you guys just meet there. And then they will give you your humanitarian visa, which is just a one-form visa. It has like my uncle, obviously being the adult, he was at the top and I was at the bottom. And then that's your passport to come to Australia, and then they will tell you where you need to do connecting flight is. So everything is organized step by step, because you can't leave any country until you get to your destination. And when you get to your destination, you have a social workers. I remember Sa, I think he's a good friend of mine now. I think you probably know him. His dad was actually my caseworker and had another social worker that was a white woman. So he was translate us to the English, to pigeon to us.
Oh my gosh. And well, I'm actually glad that the process for you was simple. I mean, it's obviously not like that these days.
But yeah, I think it was simple, but also scary. I just, like, it was 3 days journey in total. Like, you don't know anywhere. You don't know where you're going. Like, I went from being, like, you know, being with people that open their doors and, you know, you can walk in anywhere you want, to come into a country where everyone closed their door, people looking at you differently, you feel lost.
I can only imagine, like, going from you know, your whole life, everything that you knew, all the comfort that you built around you, even though you had bad experiences, that's what you knew. And you were literally leaving your family behind at 12. So it was literally just you and your uncle that traveled to Australia.
Yeah, it was. But also, I think I was also kind of glad. I don't know if it's that weird because, again, like I said at the beginning of this recording, like I didn't have any relationship with my family. So I used to look after myself regardless of what the circumstances are. Like when my mom never used to be at home, I used to have to, because I refused to ask her for money or anything like that. So I used to come from school and sell water, like put water in the fridge, and then I would take that to the street and then sell it and make money, make profit, and then do the same thing, put it in the fridge, make it cold. And then next day after school, I would do the same thing. And I used to do that even with the milk, powder milk, like put sugar, a bit of sugar in there, and then just use the teaspoon and then sell it at school, like 50 cents each. And then condensed milk, I just make condensed lollies. Hey, like
the toffee.
Yeah, mate.
Fatu the hustler. Oh,
I was
my
a
gosh.
Hustler. So when I'm like, opportunity came, I'm like, yeah, maybe this is time for me to change. But it was nothing normal for me because I'm like, maybe distance is what I need. Mm-hmm. But also I was feeling content, but also lost. But I didn't know nothing better anyway. Yeah. So
You were comfortable with the uncomfortableness.
Correct.
Like,
yeah.
And what date did you arrive?
We came to Australia. It was end of November 2004. I can't remember the date exactly, to be honest.
And so you landed in Sydney?
Correct.
What was, as soon as you stepped foot on the ground of Sydney Airport, what was your reaction? What was your feeling? What was your thought? What was going through your mind?
Where the fuck am I? Excuse my language. But, obviously coming out of the airport, like our bag started getting searched. Then I'm like, this is weird. Like, what am I carrying? But because I never used to watch TV. The only thing that I used to watch is wrestling. So I'm like, what the hell are they looking for? You know what I mean? So after all that was over, we had to drive from all the way international airport in Sydney to Manjoet Heights Street. I will never forget that street name. So that was 2-bedroom and kitchen and a living room.
So a house is already set up for you?
Everything is set up. Like,
whoa.
Yeah. So at the airport, it was the social worker from Sierra Leone who speak Pidgin that would be able to translate. And then you had another white woman that's working. So there was 2 social workers. So they would take you to your house. The fridge is packed. Food everywhere, like there's food, there's drink, and then that's your home for the day. Actually, that's your home for 3 months. And then the next day they will come and then they will take you to Centrelink to get you registered with your Medicare card, register you with Centrelink.
Wow.
Yeah. So anything else that you need, obviously government ID wise, they will do that for you. So that way you start receiving payment. And from that on, they will teach you how to catch public transport. For me, I was enrolled into community programs anywhere there's like African groups. So I was enrolled into some of those programs and then also I went to English intensive English center, which is like to learn how to speak English because I never knew how to speak English. So I was there for a year. Then after that, I went to high school. And then after the 3 months is over, obviously, they help you rent a private rental, which is deducted as well, but therefore you're on your own. But they will still link you with resources that you might be able to go and seek help if you need to.
Wow, this is actually the best migration story. Like the fact that everything was set up.
Yeah,
I didn't think it was like that. So
no, so there's different part of refugees. So you have refugee that will come here with the humanitarian visa, which is all organized by the government because they have like limited people that will take from certain country. And during those times, there were certain people that were coming from certain country. They had all funding prepared for them. So everything is set up. So 3 month rent paid for, your groceries are paid for. You don't have to pay anything until your Centrelink kicks in. Even that one, it's not by force. Mm. You know what I mean? Because they have the funding for it. So after all that's over, then you still get support, but not as well support as when you first arrive, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're set up with everything. And then after the 3 months, when you kind of get on your feet, you understand the culture a little bit more, then they kind of let you fly by yourself, but they're still there to support and keep you up.
They're pretty much in the corner. If you need help, they will be there for you. But you already know all the resources that are available for you because they already gave it to you. And then you become so comfortable because the places that they link you with are all migrant-based. So you already know, okay, I feel comfortable. Yeah, they're black, I'm black. We don't have to be from the same country. Like, after a 3 month was over from Manjua, the apartment that we moved in Blacktown Road. I still remember those suburbs. It's funny. And then there's a lot of migrant in those units because it was cheaper. It was just like a stepping stone for people to start on their own. And rent is cheaper back in there as well. So, yeah.
That's actually so amazing. And how long did it take you to learn English? Because English is the hardest language out there.
Bro, don't even get me started, mate. It took me a year. So I went to Hurstville. I think there's English Center at Hurstville because I was living with another African family at the time because I didn't want to live with my uncle, or they were like, because they knew my mom back home. So the lady asked me to move in with her and her 3 kids and her husband. So I was living with them in Bankstown. Then I started going to the Intensive English Center where I learned English at for a year. That was actually fun, learning English, but it's funny because coming from learning French, where your writing is everything's joint word, to come into a English-speaking country, then you're like, no, you can't write like that anymore. You have to break everything down. And then you're like, my brain is not understanding this nonsense, you know, because I'm so used to writing this, and now you're telling me as a 14-year-old you have to change everything that you know to start from ABC. So
it would have been so difficult.
I think it was difficult, but also a little bit, I think I felt dumb sometimes. But then I think I'm the type of person that I like to push to see what my boundaries are and then to see how far I can push myself. So I'll go home, I used to close my eyes, because Africa, you know how exam time you just overread and then till you memorize everything. So I use that technique to do the same thing here. It helped me actually, where there was one time we had an exam and I went home, I studied word by word, Vanessa. And the next day I went back to school, the teacher, obviously after the exam was finished, she couldn't believe it was me. She came back from her lunch break while we're having lunch as well. She called me in the classroom in front of everyone. She was like, can you do this exam again? She told her copy. So everyone was sitting in the classroom. I'm not even joking up. Everyone was sitting in the classroom and she was repeating the words by word and I was writing it, and she was just so, I don't know if she was admired or I don't know, or
just
shocked or disbelief that I'm actually memorizing it and then write it word for word. So, yeah, that was that time in there. But I learned a lot there, and they made me, and I made a really good friends there as well, where, like, it was a place of non-judgmental, because everyone's just like you. No one speaks English. Everyone's a refugee.
Yeah.
People just so curious learn, and then, but also funny, because the law in their country and the law here is different.
Mm.
So it was a really good way to grow a little bit and get to know the Australian life.
Yeah. You were literally thrown in the deep end. You were just immersed and you just had to figure it out.
I just had to figure it out. And then the house that I was living at the time with my friends, my mom's friends and her kids and her husband, that was toxic environment. That guy was crazy. Like, he was like a strict Muslim guy from Senegal.
So an actual blood relation?
No, I don't have any blood relation with him, but he was married to my mom's friend there. So he was just really, he's imam in the community, but he was just really bad. Like he was abusive. He's manipulative. He's gaslighting a lot. He used to wake us up like 5 a.m. or not even 5 a.m., maybe 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. to study Quran verses on the computer after prayers. And for me, he developed a kind of like, I don't know, obsessive behavior toward me, where there's one time he called me into his room to ask me about my sexual, if I've been sexually active, if, like, this is like weird, if I've been shaved under, and also it was like to me, I would like to marry you, make you my second wife. And obviously if I refuse none of those advances, he'll punish me by making me stay longer during the night and reading the Quran, and then take certain things from me. Obviously I don't have anywhere to go, so I had to survive anyway. So, and then being in an African home, you can't go to the mother and be like, hey, this is what your husband's doing. And because what I have seen in my life is like, if they end up reversing that and blame you, what did you do, rather than this adult is making these advances on me, and I know it's incorrect, in like
inappropriate.
It's inappropriate. Yeah. It's not like I'm a kid. Like, that's an assault. So it's, yeah, so that happened and it just dragged on, and eventually I end up leaving that place.
Sorry, so just to backtrack, why did you move there in the first place?
I moved there in the first place because my uncle's being a male. My mom thought it would be a good idea to live with someone that she's known.
Okay.
And then because she had three daughters as well. And
so she just thought you would have fit in a little bit more.
A lot more and stuff.
So at this time, were you keeping in regular contact with your mom and your sisters and your family? And like, how were you doing that?
I think it was once a month or twice a month. I would keep in contact with my mom and my siblings. Because there was not much relationship there. So there was nothing drawing me back to call my parents or call my mom.
And were you strong in your faith then?
I was strong in my faith. I used to read the Quran. I used to pray. I used to know my prayer verses. I still know my prayer verses. But I think it was that time that I started disbelieving in religions a little bit, because I just feel like that man that was respected in the community so well is really toxic inside the household, like, and no one's talking about it. Yeah.
And so where did you move after that?
After that, I actually moved back with my uncle and then started living with my uncle. That's when I started high school in Blackton Girls.
So going, obviously recounting all of this, there's a lot of trauma that obviously comes up, and just, you've been placed and put in some really sad and bad situation that you shouldn't have at that tender age. You shouldn't have to go through that at any age, but even more so at such a young age. Did you have support then, like in terms of counseling, in terms of any mental health support?
What's that? Honestly, I wish I had counseling support. I wish I knew what counseling was, because that would have helped me a lot, but I didn't know. And at that time, I think I was set back to the belief that it's all in your head, like you don't need anyone to talk about. And because that's been said a lot, you don't think that there's help there. You don't actually think that there's professional people that actually listen to you, that your mental health issues are validated, and then they're actually real issues that you can talk to someone about. So there was nothing like that. Yeah. So, and I felt like at that time, I feel like even if I knew what therapy was, I'll probably think that it was just like fake. What can someone do for me? Mm. I'm just going to talk to them. Are they going to solve my issues? No. Or my problem? No.
Wow. And so you mentioned when you moved that you went back to your uncle's, you were in high school, going through that process. What did you feel like you wanted to become when you finished high school? Did you have any idea what lane that you wanted to go in, or were you just kind of going through the motions of, yeah, let me just finish, get my HSC certificate and figure it out? Did you have any sort of mentoring or any sort of structure as to how you were going to form a life after high school?
No, not at all. I think I was very lost during high school. I hated school, to be honest. I hated school with passion. I didn't enjoy it. I think I didn't enjoy it because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't enjoy it because I was young. I didn't enjoy it because no one gave me a chance to learn. I've been through so much in my life that I wanted to, like, my thoughts were everywhere. Learning was not a priority, but I also understand that for you to get where you need to get some kind of learning. Because growing up, I was always told I was bullied. I was told I was dumb. I was told I was stupid. So that words were literally embedded in me, where I started believing in those words, where I'm like, I'll never be anything in my life. But also in the back of my mind, I had to think to myself, like, even if I'm not good at things, I did make something out of myself when I was in Africa, selling water and making those little moves. And I knew that I can do something. And my drive at that moment was just not to prove anyone, but also to prove myself. As much as I hated school, I would still attend school. I didn't have the best grade because I didn't even expect it. Because I finished from like intensive English center and going to high school. That's already a pressure to learn, because I had to start, instead of starting year 10, I had to start year 9, a year lower than my actual age. So I'm already like, and then the learning was not, it was not, like, I wasn't feeling it because I'm like, I don't understand what they're saying. And then that's the hardest part about it, where I'm like, I'm here, but I don't enjoy it. And then home life was not the best as well. So
school, literally just trying your best.
Yeah, school was just like an escape. You know, at least I can smile sometimes. I was so shy at school. I didn't talk to anyone because I was so reserved, because I'm like, no one just understands me. And I see people being free and I want to be free, but I can't be free because I have all these other burdens. So where is the freedom for me? Yeah.
It's crazy hearing about, I guess, your formative years and knowing who you are now. Two completely different people. Like, the fact that you said, you know, you didn't really think you would become anything, people calling you dumb. Yeah, life is crazy. Life is crazy. Life has a beautiful way of reversing some things that have happened to you in the past, because for people that know you and are privileged to know you, you are very successful, very, very successful. And I kind of want to shift a little bit to that part of your life and forming the steps that you've taken to form the empire that you're currently living in, because I know it has not been easy by any means, but you have literally gone against the grain and you've gone against all the bad that people have said about you and your life and the, you know, the success that you could have had. And I think it's important to share that part of your story. So finishing high school, what was the next step for you? Or did you go for did you go for an ATAR?
No. What's that? Vanessa, I'm just telling you, I hated school. You're asking me, what did you go for ATAR? Bro, I wanted to just say thank you very much. See ya. That was my main goal. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like,
Were you working then?
I wasn't working. I didn't know what job, like, who was going to hire me? Like, I just remember myself just being on Centrelink for a minute. And I'm just like, I knew that it was not the life for me. And I knew that I can't ask people, because my whole life I've never asked anyone for anything. Like, even I was living with my family, I still do my own thing because I don't want them to make me feel little. So I'm like, how am I going to get myself out of this position? And then sometimes I believe that a lot of people's negative words sometimes is, I use that as empowerment for myself. Not for anyone. You can be like, I don't believe in you. That's fine. That's your view. But I believe in myself. And then because you said that, I would do that. Not because to prove you wrong, but to prove to myself that I can do it. So after high school, I literally went to TAFE. And I did Certificate 3 in aged care to just look for some job. I'm like, that's a beginning or a step and stuff. So that's my first degree that I did. And I ended up getting a job in 2010, September. because I finished high school 2009 and I did my certificate 3 for 6 months and I got the job in September. Even getting that job was hard because no one was hiring anyone with no experience. So even that was, it became frustrating because I'm like, how am I meant to have experience if I'm not getting a job or I'm not given a chance? So to get that job, it was from someone who knew someone at that time, you know, where you can link people like that. So that's how I got my first job. But I think money became slowly a motivator and where I'm like, okay, I can do this. So I can do something else. And sorry, I remember one time my ex-boyfriend's sister, I think that would always stick to me, where she said, you will be nobody. And then she literally looked at me in my face when I asked her, I'm like, where she was working. And she was doing HK and she told me, oh, you can't do that job. It's not for you because you're not smart. And wow. That will always be with me. And then that's one thing that I'm always going to keep to just hold on to, not because it's negative, but because that little word did something to me. I was sitting on the couch. I remember where I was sitting. I was watching TV and she was about to open the door and she said that to me. And I'm like, okay, no worries. And then literally that's how I took it. So I got my first job. I used to work at Narrabeen and I used to live in Maryland. I didn't have a car. I used to wake up at 3 a.m., catch the night ride to Central, actually Wynyard. And then from Wynyard, I would catch another bus. I'll catch a train and then another bus all the way to DY. And from DY, the nursing home bus used to come and pick us up.
Oh my gosh.
So I would get to work exactly from 3 a.m. when I wake up, I'll get to work at 7 a.m. exactly.
7 a.m.?
7 a.m., I'm telling you. And then I'll finish 3 p.m., I'll get home, and I'll probably won't get on to 6. And I'll sleep for a minute, and then 3 a.m. again, I'll do it all again.
So how long did you do that for? How many years were you in that role? So that was full-time?
Full-time.
Monday to Friday?
Correct. And the weekend sometimes.
For how long?
I did that work until 2014. Actually, no, 2015.
Mate, it's too late for math. So how many years is that?
I don't know. It's probably... So 2000... No, 5 years.
You did that for 5 years?
5 years, because I started 2010. So I finished 2015 when I got another job.
Oh, my goodness. And so is that where you formed good money habits? Is that where you saved a lot? Is that where you... Did you have your eye on property at that stage?
No. I didn't have my eye on anything. And being naive at that time, people used to, I work and I give. I think you can call me naive, but I've been betrayed by money so much that it leaves my hand because I don't expect it back. Like people have betrayed and has used money as a weapon. Mm. So my relationship money had then developed. Like, I'll work. I'm like, if you're not, you ask me to lend you money. If you don't give me back, that's fine. I'll make peace with it and I'll move on. And I used to work. I used to make money. I didn't know what the money was going, but it was because I was surrounded by so many people who saw the child in me. And then they saw me as the most vulnerable person because I had no family. They took advantage of that. So to come next to me, they would just use money. Like, give me this, give me that, give me that. So all those years, I never used to save money. I got another job into the disability sector, 2014, end of 14. Then that's when I started saving proper money. And that was the moment I just actually said to myself, I'm like, I'm capable of doing for anything. And that was the same time I started doing nursing, bachelor in nursing. Which I did for 2 years. I didn't like. I'm like, it is what it is. And I jump into social work. And once I started doing my social work, that's where I think my motivation started coming back up and saving for things that I want started coming back up. And then that was the first time I also moved by myself. And when you come to saving, that's literally where it came from. It came from when I lived by myself for a year because I was so sick and tired of living with everybody. And I told myself I'm never living with people again. And that was literally the honest truth. I was done with a human being. And that was 2016. I went overseas. I remember being in Madrid, Spain. And I'm like, I lived in this apartment for almost 2 years now. I'm like, I'm paying someone's mortgage. And I was doing osusu at the time as well. Then I told myself, I'm like, maybe if I go back to Sydney, I can just buy my own apartment. And then obviously, again, I was surrounded by so many negative people where people were like, you can't afford it. It's too much burden. I'm like, that's fine. Like, if I don't try, I will never know.
Yeah.
So that was literally the idea. I came back and I'm a woman of my word. One thing I like about myself, and I think no one will ever take that away from me, if I say I'm going to do something tomorrow.
You will do it.
I will do it. I don't care the consequences. I don't care how it is. So I came back. I went overseas in July. I came back in August and I moved out of my house by the end of August, that house. And I started living with someone else. And by that same year, December, I put a deposit down for my first apartment.
Wow. But I think that's honestly one of the key traits of successful people. You do what you say you're going to do. It's really that simple.
Yeah.
You don't just talk about it. You actually are about action.
Yeah, because tomorrow doesn't wait for no one. Mm. Like, you can say, I'm going to do something tomorrow. Tomorrow will come. Then what? It's not going to make itself happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You actually have to do something to make moves for anything to happen. And then that's what I realized. Even though I know nothing about mortgage, when I say I know nothing, I know nothing. Mm-hmm. I literally am like, you know what? I want to buy something. And I literally just went to this real estate. Like, hey, I want to look for an apartment. And they took me to this place where you're like, oh, it's a development area. It's off the plan. It's not going to finish until 2017. I'm like, sweet. All I had money is exactly the 10% deposit. I'm like, here's my 10% deposit. And my stupid brain at the time, again, this is where people should be taught how to use money and what mortgages are. I'm like, yeah, no worry. Once I pay the 10%, the bank will automatically give me the money. So I didn't know that.
No pre-approval.
No, bro.
My, walking by faith. Oh, my God. How old were you by this time?
No, I think I'm like 26, I'm say.
26. Yeah. And so was the trip to Spain, was that like a solo trip, just a general holiday? Like, did you go with friends? Because it feels like you had a lot of light bulb moments.
It was kind of like a solo trip, but also my girlfriend was there, Christina, at the time. But that was my first time out of Australia since coming to Australia in 2004 as well. So it kind of like was eye-opener, but also seeing how the other, like everyone else live and what I'm doing with my life. Because I felt like my money was just going to people that did not deserve it. Mm. And what's for me, nothing.
And so you were renting at that time. So by the time that you came back from Spain, you just assessed and you're like, dude, I'm paying someone else's mortgage. I may as well just get my own. So you said you sought advice. Who did you get advice from? Like,
I sought advice. This is after.
After you gave the 10%.
Yeah, babe. Someone told me, don't do that. My friend told me, Christina, and Tina was like, I think that was the most dumbest stuff anyone could ever done in their life. I'm like, yeah, I know. But look,
it ended up working for you in the weirdest of
ways.
Yeah,
bro, but I had to work 3 jobs. Because being a black woman in Australia, like, I don't have any security. I don't have any family member that can pull themselves down. So I started working for three jobs.
Go back. So what were the steps? Who did you go to? Was it a broker? Was it a financial planner? Was it just the bank? Who did you go to know, okay, damn, I actually can't afford the house that I've just put money on?
Oh, it's not like I can't afford it. It's more like, oh, that's not how it works. The bank won't just give you money like that. Mm-hmm. Just because you pay 10%. You need it to actually sort out approval so you know your budget, then go and put it down. But I did it reverse way. And then that's when it was almost time for settlement or a year away from settlement, then I went to Bank of Queensland and I'm like, hey, this is what happened. But knowing me, I had a good credit. Like, I was a good work ethic. I was making good income as well. I was at university. So funny story, I walk into Bank of Queensland. I put my number down. I'm like, hey, can someone, one of your home loan specialists call me back? this person that called me back was my girlfriend from high school.
Oh.
Dara. So she called me back. She was like, Fatu. I'm like, yeah. And then she was like, Dara from high school. I'm like, what? I'm like, you work there? She's like, yeah. She's like, I saw your name. I'm like, I know that girl. I'm like, well, it's me. Mm-hmm. So I told her the story. And then she ended up doing my first loan, actually. She did my conditionally approval for me. So she did the first approval. And then obviously that lasts for 6 months. And then she was like, before the settlement, obviously we'll go for full approval. I'm like, awesome. But because it's off the plan, that's the awful part about it, off the plan. There's all this error. And if you buy from shipbuilders, people do your research. They will delay it and then just take advantage and then just drag as long as they want. And then try to give it cheap. So the council refused to approve the whole apartment itself. So you just like going back and forth with the bank. Anyway, she did the first approval and then later on something happened to her, then she referred me to Henry, and then Henry ended up doing my second approval for me.
Why Bank of Queensland? That seems so random.
Because I wanted to save, and I opened a bank with them at the time to just with no card, so all my money,
oh, like high interest savings, yeah, account. Yes. Okay,
so I was not withdrawing my money, but I was just adding more to it every time to save me me not using that particular card. And why I love their bank as well, because if you need money, if you transfer it to your other account, you will not receive it the same day. It takes 2 days or 3 days. So if you want to buy something, you just give up at that point. You're like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's too much effort.
Yeah, it's too much effort.
It's funny because we connected because you had been interviewed by kind of like a community platform called August Inc. And I read your article and I was just like, damn, this girl's inspiring. Like, she's been through it, but she came out on the other side achieving what she had set out. And we had a mutual friend at the time, so that's how we eventually actually connected, and I got to see your beautiful, beautiful, beautiful apartment.
Rest in peace.
And I feel like you even glazed over the process, because I know the process for you was a nightmare. Oh, well, obviously because you did everything back to front, but also
because I do everything back to front,
but also because just how much the bank scrutinized your spending and then you having to get those extra jobs. Like, that must have been, was it a lonely time at that time? Like, just having to just, you were just head down, grinding, hustle. I need to, because obviously you put all that money down. So you had to achieve it. You had to get that place.
Yeah, I think the funny thing about it is, because when I did my pre-approval, I had three jobs. And I was at university. So that three incomes still have to continue until the full settlement, because they need that same income, consistent income. So I could, regardless how tired I was, I had no, like, I'm like, if I stop now, I'll be declined, then my $20,000 will be gone down the drain, or whatever the 10% was at the time. So there was no chance for me to slow down. I had to work. And I was at university at the time doing, I was actually doing 600 hours of my placement for social work. So I was literally sleep at work. So I would take my outfit with me at work and I'll do most of my shift with sleepovers. So I'll do sleepover, then after that I'll go straight into my placement, which was 9 to 4. And that was because I negotiated so I can come back to work and start at 5 o'clock. So I was going back and forth, doing all that, trying to minimize my spending. My credit card balance was, I think there was one point where I had a credit card balance and I think it was overdrawn by 50 cents. They were like questioning that, and there was all drama and wahala around that. So I had to pay that off completely, close it. I got into a car accident because I was so stressed out. And I remember breaking down at one time, calling my mortgage broker. I'm like, I had enough. You know, when your emotions, just like your fatigue, you just,
everything hits you at once.
I was done at that point. I'm like, surely a better life does not have to be this long and exhausting. And I didn't have any help. And I'm not good at asking for help. And my mental health was just so overwhelming at the time. Again, I was not seeing therapists or anything. So everything was everywhere. I got into a car accident, my car got written off, and now I have no car to get to work. How am I going to get to my three jobs? I don't know. Again, me being me, I literally call my mortgage broker. I'm like, look, I have no car, and I'm not going to go and buy a second-hand car. So I literally went to BMW, Parramatta. I'm like, I want Mini Cooper. And after I said that, and then he's like, oh, okay. And I call my mortgage broker. I'm like, I got a Mini Cooper. I know this is going to affect my mortgage spending, but we have to make it work, because for me to make money, I need to have a license. I need to be able to drive. Mm. And I'm not going to get a secondhand car because I got it before. It did not take me anywhere. I end up spending more money. So I'm not doing that again. I'd rather get a brand new car where I know it's stable and I know it's going to last me a long time. And they was like, no worry, we'll try and figure it out. I'm like, yeah, we have to figure it out somewhere. Anyway, so I continued working again. Three jobs, back and back.
Were you at this time, so you were balancing full-time uni, three jobs.
Yes.
Living, renting by yourself, no external family support.
Mm-hmm.
Were you supporting, as most immigrants do, were you supporting your family back home during that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I was supporting my mum, my sister and my brother monthly or fortnightly. I actually put a spending aside for them.
Without fail, you send them money?
I would send that money because I feel like by doing that, it wouldn't feel like a burden to me because it's allocated fund to them directly. So regardless what happened, I'll send that to them.
Did you have like friends at this point, like good friends? Like you had nobody?
I had people, but I'm not good at asking for help. The people that I know that were good friends to me at the time, Tineo lived in DY. She was good for moral support. She was good for a person that I can count on, but I'm not the type of person to reach out and then grab onto something like, hey, can you support me, this and that. So I would die inside and ask for support. That's how I roll.
Yeah, that's something we're trying to work on.
I'm in therapy.
And do you remember the day that you got the keys to your new place?
Yeah, I got the key on the 25th of August, 2018.
Wow, so you don't remember the date that you came here, but you remember the, oh my gosh.
Hey babe, I'm so good with numbers, things that excited me. So I got the key. I remember the settlement was on Friday and I got the key on Saturday and I didn't have anything there. The only thing I had is my artwork. Artworks that I made because I knew how the space was going to be. And I'm like, that's how I'm going to decorate my house according to that artwork. And I took my artwork and I went to that house. You know, when you, like, I don't cry because when I get too over exhausted. So emotions, if that makes sense. Like tears don't come up.
Yeah.
Everything just feel overwhelming. Like I know it's accomplishment and people are like, that's a massive accomplishment. I'm like, oh, okay. You know what I mean? It just doesn't feel as exciting as everyone else feel. I just know I'm here. It's mine. But then anxiety started kicking in and then self-sabotaging as well. And I started having a lot of panic attack. I think it's because I have slowed down. And then I started feeling so depressed. I remember where at the time where I didn't want to be at that place because I was that depressed and then that anxious. And then started worrying about if I can afford it. Like everything bad that's going to happen, I started thinking about it. And then obviously at that time, that was my anxieties and everything coming into place. Because now I've slowed down. My thoughts are coming in and then they're flowing in very heavily. And I didn't know how to deal with that. So I was running away from it where I was digging myself into more work. And my whole plan was like, move in there. I'll settle down. I'll try and learn stillness. I'll calm myself down. I'll invent a life that I really want. It was the opposite because it just went back to doing three jobs and then not being at home.
Yeah. You sound like you're always in survival mode and that obviously comes from life back home as well. You were just always in like, you know, flight mode. Like how do I make it work? Even till this day, there's still elements of that in your life. Like you want rest, you crave rest, but I don't think you actually know how to rest. And that's not really uncommon for immigrants.
I think I'm just so scared about going back where I was. Like, I crave for softness. I crave for a place where I can be vulnerable. I crave for all that. But then once I sit down, I just, everything just becomes so overwhelming where I'm like, and I start overthinking about things that don't even, that's not going to happen. But I'm like, but it, what if it happens? Mm. I crave for stability and I have stability. Then I start asking myself, then what more do you want? Then I'm always telling myself, I'm like, Fatu, you did this, there's always a way. And I had to tell myself several times, like, if you can't afford that, you think a bank is going to take your house away from you? No, they'll help you and then have a plan in place. Not that that happened. Nothing like that happened. Matter of fact, I even got an accountant to help me because everything was so overwhelming and I can see myself sinking in depression and everything else. Then I'm like, you know what? I want some control over certain thing in my life. And financially, I don't want that control. And I want to be on top of my things. So that's when I literally joined my budget in 2018 when I moved to my apartment in Edmondson Park. And I let them worry about financial worry for me. And then let me live my life how I want to live it. And they became literally my husband. So I get paid. The money goes into their account. They distribute however they want to distribute it. And I get my savings. It's like having your, do your chores and get your money.
Yeah.
That's literally how it was. And then I'm still using it because it helped me to be independent and then not worry about financial stress. Because that's one of the biggest killers, being financially distressed.
Massive. Like, I think financial stress is honestly one of the worst stresses you can have. For a lot of people, there is no, you know, safety net. There is no emergency option. So you've done amazing, Fatu, to come here under the circumstances that you came, with the experiences that you had, the trauma that you brought, and to go into places where you thought you could trust people, you couldn't, and just move away from it, become hyper independent and just say, I'm just gonna do it. And actually doing it, achieving it, is massive. Like, there are people that were born here that haven't been able to achieve even a quarter of what you have. So
I think a lot of time people are so comfortable, and comfortable is good for you. I always said that we all crave for something comfortable, something stable. But I also feel like if you're not pushing yourself, you're not going to move. You know what I mean? You need to make yourself a little uncomfortable to be a certain point of your life. So my whole life, there has never been place that I really call home. I move from place to place. You know what I mean? So my spirit really never settled down on one place. So that's why I never get attached to certain things or certain places. But also, if I call somewhere home, I'll make sure that's a home for a while. You know what I mean? Until I decide to, okay, time to call it a quit, go somewhere else and grow, which is what's coming on my current part in my life at the moment.
I know. Speaking of moving, since that was such a massive part of your childhood, moving boldly is not something that you shy away from. You are literally moving to Melbourne tomorrow.
Is it Melbourne?
No, it's Melbourne.
Oh, okay, cool. yeah, I'm actually moving to Melbourne tomorrow. So, suckers. Sorry. yeah, I'm moving to Melbourne tomorrow because, you know how that idea actually came about?
No.
There was no ideas. My mortgage broker just sent me a flyer. He's like, I think this is something that you'd be interested in. I'm like, really? I'm like, send me a flyer. And he sent me a flyer. And I looked at it. I looked at the architecture. I'm like, oh my God, this is really my vibe. I'm like, my first home, you never felt my first home. Maybe this could be my first home. My second home also. So I'm like, yeah, I'm keen. What's the price? Can we negotiate? I'm always negotiating. I don't care. Face to face or foreign. I'm hustling. So he called the real estate agent, Simon, blessed him. And then, yeah, he called me. I'm like, hey, I'm interested in this unit. Can you take me through it? Then this time around, I did my research.
Thank God.
See, I'm a learner. I learn. So I did my research on the builders and the construction workers, and then the real estate agents. And then they were all been in business for so long. And I also looked at the previous work they have done. And then the area where they were like planning to build the house, the apartment. I'm like, cool, this is something I really... Anyway, I'm like, okay, I'll pay 5% for now. And then the next morning I woke up and I'm like, okay, what am I doing in Sydney? This was like literally last year, March. I woke up, I'm like, I call Simon, I'm like, I think I'm moving to Melbourne. Can you check how much the stamp duty is if someone live in there? And then he came back, he's like, oh, it's cheaper. You get a concession, it's cheaper. I'm like, say less. Send me the contract. He sent me the contract. I never read anything. The contract is like a Bible. So I'm sitting there at night, I'm reading through it, and they're saying to me, I'm like, oh, carpet in the bedroom? I'm like, I hate carpet in the bedroom. I'm escaping the carpet from the bedroom. So I asked him in the morning, I'm like, I'll make a deal with you. If I get free carpet, I mean, sorry, timber in the bedroom as well, then I'll pay the other 5% by the end of the month. I was like, oh, I don't know if my boss will be happy with that. I'm like, if just ask. So he come back next morning. He was like, yeah, my boss approved. I'm like, say less. say less. So I send the other 5% the end of March, and then the rest is history. And yeah, it's just been the best actually experience, this other building, to be honest, beside the bank being stressful. They just literally want everyone to work till they die. But anyway, yeah, so that's literally, I bought my second home in Melbourne. So I'm like, instead of going to another state, living there, renting it, how about if I can afford it? So I invested my property in Sydney and then going to live in the one in Melbourne.
Love that for you, sis. And I would regularly get updates about the new property in Melbourne, and the process does seem like it's been very, very breezy.
Like, I love the recap they send you as well. Every 3 months they tell you where they're up to. It feels like you're actually part of the whole process, which may give you like a lot of peace, you know? Like today the building workers call me like asking, like, I thought they were joking first. It was so lovely. It was like, oh, this is what's happening there at the moment. I'm like, are you sure this is the building? 7 o'clock. And then literally he had to reassure me. He's like, no, we're actually the buildings.
Oh my God.
So it's kind of like building that relationship, but also knowing that, okay, this is the perfect decision for me. Like, I don't know what Melbourne is going to be like, but I'm optimistic. I want to grow. And the best thing about this journey for me is because I made the decision myself. I wasn't told by my mom. I wasn't told by my sister. I wasn't told by my cousins. I wasn't told by the government. It was just me making the choice by myself. And I am very content with that choice. And I'm very excited about that choice. I'm just so excited about like what's ahead of me and the opportunities that I'm going to have. Job-wise, I have a job lined up already. And so that's not even scary. I have a few friends there. And then that's all I need, to be honest. And just navigating the Melbourne life the way I want to and being at peace.
Very, very blessed. Are there any like specific goals, both personal and professional, that you want to aim for in Melbourne?
No, I just want to grow. Maybe start a business if possible. Can't come and kill myself working for someone else. I do love my job as child protection or social worker. But it would be nice to start a side hustle. In Melbourne, and yeah, travel a lot more. I think the next 5 years is just more of me living, not being stressed, because I miss that part of me. Like, I miss being soft, I miss being chill on my sofa on a Friday night, you know. So I'm looking for that next chapter where I can be so relaxed and not worry. And yeah, and now I'm on therapy as well, so which is great.
Very, very good. And do you feel like you moving as a kid has had like a positive influence on you knowing how to be very agile and adaptive to whatever situation comes your way? Like, you're not, as you said, you don't really get too attached to things. Is that because for a long time you didn't even have the opportunity to attach to something because you were on to the next thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in Sydney alone, I moved probably 10 houses.
10?
Honestly, 10 houses. 10 houses. God. Couch surf, name it. I've done it all. I lived everywhere in the Western suburb. And through all that, I learned that, obviously, like you mentioned before, survivor mode. Yes, I was in survivor mode. But also, I remember telling myself one time, like, let people think that you're full. Like, I'm just trying to survive. Because sometimes that's what carries you to your next life and your next stage in your life. Act like a fool, but you're not a fool at the end of the day, you know? But let them treat you how they want to treat you. When you get where you need to be, them that's going to watch you from above and be like, yep, yeah, I know that girl. No, you don't know me. You know of me. That's the thing.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Facts. Do you feel content with where you are in life right now?
I think I feel very content where I am today, where I feel blessed. I am really, like, knowing my life path, where I've been, what I've been through, I am very content. I am blessed. And I wish I can say that someone else helped me, but no one did. Mm. I did it all by myself. I'm a hustler. I survive regardless of what the circumstances are. And I think as an adult, now as a 32 years old, I'm learning to be like adapt to places. I'm learning to be more calm and more at peace, but also because I've been betrayed so many times in my life to trust. My friend circle is very small, and they've influenced me as well. I always say that, you know, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are. And my friends are my family, as I don't have any connection with my family. And my past is my past. And, you know, I should never have to be strong. I should never have to be brave. I think as a child, I should just be a child and not grow up to have all these memories that remind me of unpleasant time in my life. I still can't look at my childhood photo because I hate it. Like, because I know that that person, that girl has no soul. And it's something that I'm working on, but I know people like, yeah, touch, like, you know, hold yourself, a young self, and say, like, you know, you're proud of it. Like, I know she's proud of me, but I wish I can go back and hug that girl and then love her a lot more, because I just feel like she deserves a lot more. And then the picture that I always have with me that I will never let anyone see, she just has no life. Like, her, you look into her eyes, there's nothing there. And it's sad. And I feel sorry for it.
You've absolutely, absolutely changed that narrative. I feel like you're such a testament to hard work, you know, perseverance and favor. You obviously have a lot of favor over your life as well. And you've kind of answered it, but in a more direct way, what advice would you give your younger self when you first migrated to Australia? Like, what would that be, coming into this foreign world that you didn't even know existed, that you literally got a paper handed to you and said, hey, you know, do you want to move?
Yeah, sure.
What would you say to that younger girl that you're saying looked soulless?
I don't know. You did it.
Amen.
I think you did it. Like, you worked so hard. But I feel like, yeah, she did it. She worked so hard. She fought through it all. It wasn't easy, but you made it look easy. And you made it so humble as well. I don't know, like, I think about that person, I still feel emotional a little bit, to be honest. Like, I don't like to talk about my young self because I just, yeah. Like, I wish I loved her more. I do love my young self more, but I just, yeah. I think she was very lost. I think everything that I have achieved today, it's because I wanted to make something out of myself. Because of the hurtful words that I've received from people that loved me, and that my young self had to deal with all that, you know. And beside that, she just still continued to do what she needed to do. and then made it through life. And I'm always going to be proud of her, but I wish that she was loved a lot more because she didn't know what love was. A lot of heartache in life became to follow her, and a lot of betrayal started repeating themselves because I was craving so much love that people just gave me anything because they saw what I needed, but it was not genuine. And then that makes me sad because I just feel like at the moment I work in the social services, I see kids who want so much love, and I can't sit there and be like, I'm just going to manipulate you and then smile, but I know that I don't mean that smile. Mm-hmm. I think that's really painful, and then that's very like heartless thing to do to people or to kids. But yeah, I'm very, like, I'm at this Fatu now, I'm very happy with her. I'm content, I'm blessed. I smile sometimes when I think of my life, how it is and where I'm going and how far I've come. So if anyone out there, keep doing your dream, to be honest. You're your own superpower.
What a way to end the pod. Aye. Thank you for inspiring us, Miss Fatu Silla. Thank you for just being authentic in your storytelling, authentic in owning your story, those parts of your story that you didn't have to share, but you were comfortable enough to share it, and just a testament to hard work and achieving anything that you put your mind to. So thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you? Because you do a lot of work in the community as well with FGM awareness.
Yeah, I do.
Obviously your social work. Mm-hmm. Obviously I know you need to have an alias as well because, yeah, it's rough out there in the online streets. Yeah. But you do a lot of amazing stuff. You've got a very creative eye. I think that you're yet to dive into that, and maybe that's, yeah, you know, watch this space.
I think I'm just lazy at the moment, but I'll get into that.
But is there anywhere people can kind of follow any type of any of your work? Or
I think if you want to follow my life story, it's just out there. It literally says, I hope I inspire you, and that's my
is that your mantra?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so where do we follow?
Oh, follow you. Oh, sorry.
It's not by force, if there's nowhere.
By force. Just follow me on Instagram or Facebook. I'm on Twitter, I think, or X now. But yeah, just Fatu. With the Z.
Love that. Thank you so much, Fatu, for your time.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Catch you in the next episode.
Yeah. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening. Yeah.